I live in Israel. This season is dedicated to the memory of the 1,400 of my countrymen who were massacred on October 7th and the 240 people that were kidnapped and are being held hostage by the terrorist organization Hamas. Hopefully they will be returned to their families as soon as possible, and hopefully this terrible war will be able to come to a peaceful end very soon. Hello, everyone, and welcome to minute 47 of season 6 of Movie Ramen, the daily podcast where we take a Capra-esque journey through the 1946 classic, It's a Wonderful Life, 1 minute at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me once again today is Scott Myers, an associate professor of screenwriting at DePaul University. Welcome back to the show, Scott.
Great to be here, continuing this conversation about one of my favorite movies, It's a Wonderful Life.
Yeah, and I mean, you also, I mean, I can mention the fact that you, when I invited you, I asked you if there's anything in particular, any scene in particular you wanted, and you were adamant that this is the scene that you wanted, and you know, I was very happy to let you have it, because you know, when someone has a favorite scene in the movie that I'm doing, why not give them the opportunity to be able to talk about it?
Well, thanks. It's an important scene. I use it all the time when I'm talking about subtext with my students, the actual telephone conversation. But
yeah,
we'll get to that, I'm sure.
Exactly. So, what's your background with the movie itself? Do you remember when you first saw it? Do you remember why you like it so much?
I remember it. My family was quite religious. We'd go to Christmas Eve midnight, you know, service every, you know, it was like 11 o'clock candlelight service. And I came home one night. This is when I lived in Virginia Beach, and I'm always curious, like, back in the day, this is ancient history, when there were like three channels, there was not cable. And I was always interested, like, what programming would people have at midnight and Christmas Eve? And I flipped around, and there's this grainy film that, you know, just like literally just started. And I'm watching this thing. And by the end, I'm up until 2:30 in the morning watching this. And by the end of it, I'm like sobbing. And that was It's a Wonderful Life. And I've been just captured by it ever since. It's like, why did this movie have such an emotional impact on me, and obviously over the years on a lot of people. So yeah, I absolutely remember the first time I saw it. It was in my living room at my parents' house on Christmas, what turned out to be Christmas Day, until about 2:30 in the morning. Yeah,
right. Oh wow, that is a great story. You know, and like, you knew nothing about it beforehand. It just, you came across it randomly.
Nothing. I just was flipping channels, and I saw. Well, I'm a movie fan, so I saw. And Jimmy Stewart was my favorite actor. And so I saw that, and I was like, oh, okay, wait, you know, we got to watch this.
How old were you at the time?
I was in college, so I was probably like 20 or 21.
Ah, okay. For some reason, I had in my mind that you were a lot younger at that point, like, you know, when you saw it. So you only saw it for the maybe, first time?
Yeah. Well, this was 19. I don't think people even knew about it that much. I don't know when it started, you know, because the movie came out and did not do well when it came out theatrically. But this was probably 1972, maybe 73. And the print, as I say, was just this really grainy, lousy print. It was just on a local TV network, you know, mm-hmm. at like midnight. I'd never heard of it at that point. And I was a movie fan. So maybe the Renaissance didn't really start happening until then or later. I don't know.
Wow. Okay. All right. That's very, very interesting. Thank you. Thank you very much for sharing that with us. So minute 47 begins with Mrs. Hatch asking the ultimate question and ends with Mary answering the phone in a very angry way. So yesterday we ended things with, you know, George and Mary are sitting on the couch, both of them in different ways uncomfortable. You know, not necessarily sure what the other one wants there. You know, they're not necessarily on the same wavelength. And then they're interrupted when Mrs. Hatch screams down from upstairs and wants to know who's with Mary. You know, who's she talking to? And she responds that it was George. And her mother ends yesterday's minute by saying, George Bailey. And then today we continue with what she was saying. It's just, what's he want? And I gotta say, I've always loved this reaction from Mary. And, you know, she like screams back to her mother, I don't know. And then she like turns to George and says it in a quiet way, what do you want? And I think it's great. I think it's great because George really doesn't know what he wants.
No. You know, this is, again, from a screenwriting standpoint, like we were talking about yesterday, this is just wonderful craft because it's on the surface, it's a legitimate question. Like, what do you want? Why are you here? But there's a deeper meaning to it. Like, there's a subtext to it. I mean, Mary's not intending it. But from a story standpoint, what do you want is like literally a key existential question for George Bailey. He knows he wants to get away, but what does he really need? And so this, what do you want? I think just, and it sets up for the telephone call too.
Correct.
Because he says, well, we'll talk about it later, but anyhow, yeah, it's just a great way of framing that this is not just about this moment, but just about the bigger picture of George Bailey's life.
Yeah. I mean, this whole week, we're going to be talking about the connection between what's happening with George right now and what is going to be happening with him throughout the rest of his life. You know, like, what is the existential question of George's life? You know, it all fits in together the same way.
Yes, absolutely. And that question, what do you want? It's but her performance in this scene is great. I mean, she just did a great job. And if you look just like what you're talking about, I don't know. And then she turns to him. What do you want?
What do you want? But
what do you want? Yeah. But nobody doesn't want.
Well, again, I don't know if we even know that. We don't know what he wants or what he doesn't know what he wants and what he doesn't want. Because, I mean, as we mentioned yesterday, there's still a reason that he came to Mary's house. You know, even if in his mind he does not want Mary, he's not looking for a relationship. He's not looking for, you know, to share his life with anybody. He still went to her house. So, and it wasn't to go, you know, see Mrs. Hatch. And it wasn't to go see Marty, who's not there, which I always find really funny that, you know, the Hatches have two kids, Mary and Marty. You know, I guess it makes it easier to, you know, everyone has the same initials and, you know, you just have to add one letter.
So well, I hadn't thought about that, but that's right. Yeah, just add the T to Marty. I think this gets back to that thing about want and need. The want, you know, is like, I don't want to hang out. I don't want to get married. But the need is underneath there. And that's why that romance scene where they were singing together after the graduation party, where he did connect with her and did have feelings for her. That's still there, but it's just down underneath, you know, a lot of resentment about being stuck in Bedford Falls. And it emerges here and subsequently in the telephone call.
Right. But again, I mean, as I mentioned yesterday, that was 4 years ago. You know, what, yeah. You know, she moved on with her life. She went, I think George's mother 2 weeks ago said that Mary's home from college. So it means she went to go study something. She got out of town. You know, we know that Sam Wainwright is also out of town because, you know, even at the graduation party 4 years earlier, you know, he was already talking about the fact that, you know, that he's in college also and everything like that. So it, you know, we know that Mary has, Mary's not been stuck in Bedford Falls, but even though she's seen the outside world, not necessarily the same type of things that George wants to see, but she still has seen, she's basically left the perimeter of Bedford Falls, which it seems that George hasn't. So she knows what's out there, and she's not interested in what's out there. She's interested in what's in here.
Right.
You know, so I find that very interesting also.
They have a moment where he said, why'd you come back? And, well, I just, you know, I missed home and things. She looks at him.
That's right. Yeah. You know, she really has been pining for him all these years. And his mother noticed, but he didn't notice. So,
yeah.
I don't know. But also the when George responds, me, not a thing, I just came in to get warm. He has this look on his face as if he's been like caught in the headlights.
Yeah.
You know, and it's funny that he
That
says just to get warm. We've already established this is the summer. So it must be a chilly summer evening in Bedford Falls.
again, this is a situation where he's reacting. It's like the mother
Right.
has this thing. His mother, tells him to go see Mary Hatch. She has the answers, or something, and off he goes. Remember, she's that way, and then he turns and goes the other way because he doesn't want to. But he's reacting to Mary Hatch's mother. He's reacting to Mary Hatch, and he's caught in the, as you mentioned, he's sort of like a deer in headlights. It's like, what's
Yeah,
going on?
that's right. And the whole time he's like fidgeting with his hat, and then he like tosses it onto like a little a little table in front of him or anything like that. And it's done so nonchalantly, and it's great because as I mean, I've seen this movie so many times, but I never noticed unless you're looking at a movie in this much detail, you don't notice that a character is going to put something down and then later on forget that it's there. Because the audience also forgets that it's there. So
Yeah,
it's
well, when we
done,
get to it.
that's right, it's done very cleverly that he's just playing with his hat and then just tosses it. And is it,
That
and
well, I was going to say, from a screenwriting standpoint, that's absolutely critical. If he doesn't forget the hat and come back for the hat, they may never have gotten together.
oh, for sure, for sure. I understand the reasoning behind it. I just think it's great that as a moviegoer, you won't necessarily notice these things,
No,
because
very
it's done
subtle.
so subtly. It's not like you're going to say, "Oh, you forgot your hat." It just, there are movies where you see that someone forgets something, and you feel like screaming at the screen, "No, you forgot this," or "You didn't do that." Those are usually in thrillers, or in horror movies where you said, "Don't go in there," that type of thing. But
Yeah.
in this case, it's just done very in a very subtle, nonchalant fashion, and I really like the way they did that. And then Mary makes one of the craziest comments that I've ever heard in this movie, and she screams to her mother, "He's making violent love to me, mother." And then her response is, "You tell him to go right back home, and don't you leave the house either." So, it's looking at this movie from a 2023 perspective. That sounds very, very inappropriate. I don't know how many people these days would say that to their parents if their parent was upstairs and they said, "What are you doing with your boyfriend slash girlfriend?" And you would respond this way. I don't know, how pleasant the reaction would be.
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean,
Right.
nowadays that would be, probably mean something else.
That is
I
right.
was thinking
Nowadays,
like,
you're
I
calling
just love, I
911.
love, yes. I was like, Mary Hatch is character. She's got she's smart. She's witty. She's got the just a real intelligence about her. And we've seen that from the very get-go. And so the way she reacts here in this scene, that comment is just in line with that. Like, that's just a really funny, smart thing to say. Now, maybe in 2023 language, not necessarily so, but just this kind of sarcastic tone. She's more than just a typical romance figure.
Correct.
She's got some depth and complexity to her. It's great.
Yes. But I mean, I looked it up, and back then the phrase "making love," it was very different than what it is today. It I guess it's all in context. But the context back then was very different. Because making love basically meant making out. So that's a little different. It's a
So
question
making
of
violent love would be like
he's
passionate
kissing
necking or
me,
something?
passion, exactly, passionate necking. That would be the apparently the at the point where it started become think people started thinking of it differently was in after 1938, because in the novel Rebecca by Daphne du Maurier, that there's a phrase, "I should make violent love to you behind a palm tree." At that point, the euphemism already did mean sex, but I mean, this is supposedly taking place in 1932, and even at that time, on the on in you know on the screen, things are going to be a little different than what they would be in literature. The fact that in the novel, Rebecca, they said that, but they don't say that in the movie, already says something also. So
Interesting.
yeah, I just found it very interesting. I mean, it's just a very strange comment unless you know what it actually means. I mean, basically, it used to mean that to make you love me. It could be maybe someone was flirting, someone was proposing marriage, someone was trying to convince someone to go out with them, stuff like that.
I
But
wonder if there's a little bit of a callback here. Remember that scene where, of course you do, where they're out, after the graduation party and they're just singing, and that guy's saying, "Why'd you go ahead and kiss her?"
that's right. I
This
actually
may be a
love that
little bit of a
phrase.
callback to that. Okay.
It could be. It could be, because I mean, basically, he says, what is he? Love
Youth
is
is
wasted
wasted on the
on
young.
youth. No, love is wasted on the youth, or something like that, isn't it? Or Roman. I don't remember the
I think
exact
it's youth
formula.
is wasted on the young or something, but
Something like that, yeah.
he's just pissed off that George is not, he's talking too much,
That's right. He should be
and then
following
kiss her.
through. That's right. Yeah. So yeah, I mean that again. They're not talking here about. She's not saying to her mother that he's doing something to me that you would not necessarily approve of. I think she's also trying to goad her mother at the same time by saying, because her mother's been bugging her, and her mother keeps bugging her. When you listen to what she says, because at this point, her mother says, "And don't you leave the house either. Sam Wainwright promised to call you from New York tonight." So my question about that is, Sam promised Mrs. Hatch that he would call to talk to Mary, because
I never
Mary's
thought
not
about that. I
concerned
just
about
figured.
that.
No, I figured that Sam talked to Mary, and Mary mentioned it to the mom, and so that's well, that's the way I looked at it. But
Yeah, but Mary
it's
doesn't
a
care. That's what it is. I mean, it could be understood either way. It definitely still could be understood that, that her mother's reminding her that Sam is supposed to call tonight.
it's a key piece of exposition. From a screenwriting standpoint, you've got to lay that in there in order to set up the fact that the call is going to happen. So,
Right. And then at this point, George then says, "What's your mother mean? I didn't come here to." So first of all, what did her mother mean about what? That he should leave and tell him to go right back home? The whole, it's great that this conversation, it's basically three people that are talking to one another, but none of them are listening to what the others are saying. It's like three different conversations going on at the
And
same time.
especially George is completely flummoxed by what's going on. Again, he's reacting. He's like, he's
That's
caught
right.
in this maelstrom of stuff. And it's like, what, my mother, your mother, you, I don't even know what to do, which eventually leads to him wanting to leave. So.
But again, he's just not, he knows that his mother wants him there. So he showed up. And now her mother doesn't want him there. So it's just like, what? The whole thing is, he's very confused at this point as to what's going on. And then he goes, I didn't come here to." And then she cuts him off. "Well, what did you come here for then?" And then he looks and goes, "I don't know. You tell me. You're supposed to be the one that has all the answers. You tell me." So you see, he's not even married yet, and he's already smart enough to know that his wife is gonna, know all the
Oh,
answers.
that's great. Well, that's a callback, right? Because that's what the mom said. You're supposed she has the answers, right?
That's right. That's right. That's right. And then, "Well, why don't you go home?" And he goes, "That's where I'm going." And they have this little spat between the two of them, basically, which, the conversation over the last minute and a half has led to this point. I mean, we saw that it was going here because, they're both very. She's very passionate, and he's very dispassionate about this conversation. He's still trying to figure out why he's there, and she knows why she's there, and she's hoping that he will want to be there for the same reasons. or anything like that.
Yep. They bring it a different emotional state of being at the beginning of the scene, which we talked about yesterday. And that's right. the from our screenwriting standpoint, that's great because you got this conflict between them that you can then exploit.
Mm-hmm. Right. And then he gets up and starts, wants to leave. And then, you know, as he's storming out of the house, we hear the phone begin to ring. And, you know, he says, as he's walking out, he goes, "I don't know why I came here in the first place." And she says, "Good night. Good night." And then the phone keeps ringing. And then Mrs. Hatch from upstairs goes, "Mary, Mary, the telephone. It's Sam." So again, it goes back to I see that in my house. You know, the phone will ring and the landline will ring and nobody wants to go answer it. You know, anyone, if it's your cell phone, everyone goes and grabs it. But if it's the landline, nobody wants to respond here. You know, you think that Mrs. Hatch wouldn't have a problem answering the phone.
Yeah.
You know, to just then call down and say, "Mary, you know, Sam's on the phone." It's not that difficult. And then Mary says, "I'll get it." And then as Mary continues walking towards it and George leaves, you can see that she's upset also. And then she turns off the music and takes the record and smashes it, just, you know, breaks it.
Again, that's like one of those moments where you just feel like she's got emotional depth. She's not just a romance figure. You know, she's got mm-hmm. the ability to get pissed off. You know, she's got some emotional range.
That's right.
So it's a great job in terms of exploring her character. And you know, she's a much more complex figure than you would anticipate, perhaps, in this type of romance relationship.
And I love the way that after she breaks the record, she like holds her head.
Like a headache.
You know, as if she has, as if she's about to get a headache. Exactly. Yeah. I have that ring down. She feels like a migraine coming on and stuff like that.
Yeah, it's great.
And Mrs. Hatch then screams down and says, "Whatever were you doing that you couldn't hear?" Well, didn't she just tell her that George is making violent love to her? You know, why else can't she hear? I don't know. And then, you know, Mrs. Hatch, the phone rings again, and Mrs. Hatch once again says, "Mary, he's waiting." You know, and her mother's pretty nosy at this point.
Oh, yeah. Her mother's dreams of Mary being, you know, with Sam Wainwright being the son-in-law. He's a rich dude.
That's
you
right.
Know, that's what she mm-hmm. wants. You know.
Right. Right. And then she goes to the phone and answers it. And you can see that she's answering it in a very angry way. And she goes, "Hello." Even though she knows who it is. And as she's answering the phone, that's when the minute ends. So, Scott, you have anything else you want to say about this minute?
No, there's a beginning, middle, and an end to this whole scene. And this is the middle of it, you know, with the beginning of the middle of it, where they've had this argument and he storms off. And, you know, it looks like, from a dramatic standpoint, it looks like, oh my God, that's it. They're never going to get together again. But that's where the hat comes in, you know, because he forgot his hat.
Correct. But we don't know that yet. We're only going to find that out tomorrow.
Yeah.
Well, we know because we're able to tell the future, but George doesn't know this, and neither does Mary, and Mary's mother especially doesn't know it. You know, I think that would have caused even more of a problem. All right, so every Tuesday we have a segment called Off the Beaten Track Uplifting Story Edition, where my guest will give some sort of story that's happened to them. An anecdote, adventure, misadventure, something's happened to them over the course of their life that has been somewhat of an uplifting story for them. So, Scott, you have any story for us?
I absolutely do. I tell my students every class, or first class session, I tell them that edict that Joseph Campbell says about the hero's journey: follow your bliss. Find something that energizes you, that enlivens you, that you have a talent for, you want to share with the world. Do that as an avocation or vocation. But you do that, and that's the path of leading to an authentic life. And so I left Yale. I got a graduate degree. I was going to get a doctorate, but I left to pursue music. I played music for 7 years. I did stand-up comedy for 2 years. And it all led to one night. I had no idea. It all led to one night in Ventura, California, as I was breaking down my equipment after a gig, where this guy had been as a student at the USC Peter Stark program. And that very day, his script that he had that he was going to use for his thesis to market and budget and all that stuff got optioned. And so he looked at me and said, well, maybe you could write a screenplay. And I said, I can do that. I'd never read one. I never knew what a screenwriter was, really. But I knew I loved movies and I could tell stories. And that's how I broke into the business, was that singular moment in time. It just so happened that the very night I played this club, and this guy walked in and said, we're friends. And he said, I needed a script. Maybe you could write one. I said, I can do that. And I did. And that's how I've led this whole journey of the rest of my life. It was all because of that moment.
Oh, wow. That is really cool.
Yeah, it is.
It's a good thing you didn't have Mary Hatch next to you trying to discourage you from doing that.
Yeah. <that's, laughs> But it just shows that Campbell says, when you follow your bliss, the universe will create doors where there once were walls. And I believe that.
Oh, wow. That's really cool. How many years ago was that?
This is 1986, and I've been screenwriting ever since.
What was the movie that you wrote that screenplay for?
Write What You Know, right? So I wrote a script called Stand Up. It was about a stand-up comedian who got partnered with Jonathan Winters, essentially, that type of figure who was very funny, but also having a psychological he was in a psychologically disjunctive state, and they go on tour together. And it was not a very good script, but it did lead me to writing Canine, which was the third script I wrote, and that sold to Universal and got produced and had two sequels and so forth. So I've been, in the business ever since.
Oh, wow. That's really cool. Wait, you wrote the movie Canine?
Yeah.
With Jim Belushi?
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Oh, wow. See, I didn't know that. See, on IMDb, it doesn't show that. It shows a TV show or a TV movie named Canine. Mm.
No, it's
so they have the wrong Canine there.
Yeah. Well, they did have a pilot for ABC that never got picked up to go to series.
I think that's the one they're referring to here.
Yeah. But no, the movies.
Mean, that's interesting. It means that they don't have the your credit on Canine then.
I don't know. I don't.
Oh wait, it does. Ah, your Scott Myers is listed numerous times here. Yeah. It says the writer is Scott Myers and Steven Seagal. Steven Seagal. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Not Steven Seagal. That would have been a hoot working with that guy. No, Steven Seagal.
Oh, that's really weird. It does. Okay, it does. It does jump back there. Okay. On IMDb it is right. Now I see. Oh, that's really cool. Wait, so were you on the set? I know this isn't about this. It's a Wonderful Life, but were you on the set when the movie was being made?
Yes, for a couple of weeks down in San Diego. Yeah, I was there for some of the key scenes, like the scene where in the bar where the dog attacks a guy and grabs him by his crotch in order to get some information. Jerry Lee, the dog. Mm-hmm. I was there for when Belushi's character drives a rental car into a crack house, and smashes through in order to, so it was a lot of fun. You know, movie did well. It was number one at the box office for a week. And as I say, it spawned two sequels. And then I've written over 30 other projects for every major studio and almost every, broadcast network. So, yeah. I continue to write, but I also teach, so that's my main thing nowadays.
Oh, wow. That is really cool. That is really very, very cool. Did like you have to do a lot of rewrites on the spot, or they don't, or that's just, that doesn't really happen anymore?
Oh, no, they're rewriting all the time. I mean, there were other people that came on and wrote, which is very typical, of Hollywood. It was right during the strike, too, and so it was a little, the 88 strike, when they were making it.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was a little odd because you weren't supposed to be doing any writing on set. And at that point, we weren't even involved in the writing. So there may have been some people who were there illegally or scabbing or whatnot, but I never saw them. We rewrote the script a couple of times and then they brought in some other people, but we ended up with sole credit. So.
Oh, wow. Okay. That's very cool. Thank you. Thank you very much for sharing.
Sure.
I appreciate that. Yeah. So do you want to tell people once again where they can find Scott Myers besides on IMDb under Canine?
So, yeah, there's my blog, Go Into the Story, is the official screenwriting blog of The Blacklist. It's been around for 15 years, got thousands of articles, so you can go check that out. That's on Medium. And then I do teach at DePaul University, so there's that. But then I have a book out that I wrote, came out about a year ago. It's done quite well. It's called The Protagonist's Journey. It's kind of an homage to the hero's journey. The Protagonist's Journey, an Introduction to Character-Driven Screenwriting and Storytelling. And it's been on Amazon, number one bestseller and five-star rated book in film and TV. So I encourage people, if they're interested in character-driven storytelling, as opposed to just the formulaic how-to that so many of the books seem to do, they could check that out.
All right, very cool. And finding me is very simple. Just do a quick search for Movie Rob Minute. You can find me on Facebook, you can find me on Twitter, and you can find me on my website, movierobminute.com. So, until tomorrow, hot dog.
Hot dog.
I love you truly, truly dear. Life with its sorrow, life with its tears.